and welcome. I hope you're enjoying a Carlisle day. I have a very special guest with me. That is probably the person responsible for getting me onto Carlisle in the first place, and that is Curtis Yarvin, also known as Mencius Molebug. Welcome, welcome, Curtis. How are you doing?
Great, great. Real pleasure to be here.
So let me ask my first question then, which is, how did you become interested in Carlisle? What drew you to him?
That's a good question. And I don't know, for a lot of authors, I know the basically trail that got me there. I don't really remember that exactly to Carlisle. I think this was at a time when I was sort of breaking out of the kind of modern box, or the revolutionary box, if you will, because I'd read Hans Hermann Hoppe, and that sort of brought me into the world of pre-revolutionary or counter-revolutionary thought. And, you know, what I can remember is the first time I stumbled on Carlisle's prose. It's amazing how hard it is to get people to read Carlisle. You know, the first time I stumbled on Carlisle's prose, I was just like, this is too naughty. I'm like, you know, I sort of didn't have the faith that you could parse that and understand with sort of tremendous clarity what is going on there, because you see so much writing in vaguely similar styles. It's just continental, obfuscated, and pointless. And there's certainly something continental in Carlisle's style, but I think that he's basically, I think, one of the few English writers who you could mention, whose name you could mention in the same breath of Shakespeare. Is that going too far?
No, I think that there's he has got I mean, obviously he's a very different style of writer from
of course Shakespeare.
But I would say that he has a lot of very idiosyncratic elements that put him, I mean, he's definitely up there with the best rhetoricians of all time in the English language.
Sure.
I would say,
yeah. Sure. And so, you know, for those who kind of parse Carlisle, you know, sometimes if, like, you know, people will ask me, you know, who was Carlisle, I'll be like, well, he was the Victorian Jesus, you know, and that's really not quite right. But the level of sort of inspiration he produced in people who connected with his work, which was, yeah, I mean, it was certainly never the kind of main direction of society, that main of intellectual society, that direction always remained with Victorian liberalism, I think. But the, you know, he was always kind of a man outside his time, or certainly after the appearance of the occasional discourse in the Latter-day pamphlets, he was. And which is very appealing. I think I started to parse, maybe, you know, I think one of the reasons, the ways people go wrong with Carlisle is that, you know, the first book they're told to read is Heroes and Hero Worship, which is, it's a fine enough book. It's not a bad book. It's really much more parsable on, like, I feel it was spoke more immediately to the audience of its time than the present. Whereas I always want people to jump into, and I really don't remember how I found this, the Latter-day pamphlets. And I used to just click around a lot on sort of Google Books, just taking a kind of deep bath in the past, kind of going from sort of, you know, Victorian hyperlinks to one book, from one book to another. It's the only way to find things. It's very time consuming, and just, you know, such an immersive pleasure. And I stumbled on, however it was, I found the Latter-day pamphlets and was just like spellbound by these. I mean, you can only call them sermons. They're like, and I think Carlisle himself was once asked about these, because these basically, before he started writing this stuff, he was kind of, you know, he was very much the friend of Mill. He was considered as kind of a liberal literary enfant terrible. And then he writes this just outrageously, basically in response to the revolutions of 1848, he writes this astoundingly reactionary material, which is just completely out of step with anything anyone wants or believes. And you know, which sort of breaks up all kinds of friendships and relationships and so forth for him. And I think at one point he's asked, you know, why do you even write this stuff? Nobody like could take it seriously. And he's like, I'm not writing for now. I'm writing for like 200 years in the future. So you can say that again, right? And to just discover this like totally abandoned work that like sort of even Carlyle scholars, I think, are just kind of a little bit horrified by and certainly can't take seriously in the context of the present. And then reading it and being like, no, actually, this is actually addressed to us. This is talking to our time in very clear and vivid language that like doesn't take a huge amount of knowledge of the 1840s to translate. What was your reaction to reading the pamphlets? I mean, you know, do you consider them as important as I do? Do you?
I actually agree with you that if you're coming to Carlyle from a kind of reactionary, you know, you want something to get your teeth stuck into, Latter-day pamphlets is a very good first place to land. So I kind of agree with that. I just love some of the bits in there where he's like, you know, can you imagine how grim like Victorian prisons were? But Carlyle has a tour of a Victorian prison, and he's like, they're not harsh enough. You know, they need to be.
Well, I mean, it's a new Victorian prison. You know, it's like this is already under the influence of the prison reformers. You know, but yeah, no doubt in quality they varied. Well, I mean, new prisons are always better than old prisons, I think. But just his, you know, and the way he's sort of speaking against, you know, the humanitarianism of the time, not by sort of having this like Rand or Nietzsche, like, you know, but like sort of revealing its inhumanity is like, unique.
One of the aspects that I appreciated because you were my real starting place, I started with the Latter-day pamphlets and worked backwards,
right.
You know, so I don't know how many people have done that. One of the things I started to really appreciate was like Carlyle the ship poster or meme artist, if you want, because he's got such a thick vocabulary of what people call like Carlyleism or Carlyleese, you know, the 30,000 distressed needle women, the universal quagmire, you know.
Right. The names, Dry as Dust, you know, and his many friends.
I think my favorite is probably Bobus Higgins, sausage maker on the great scale.
Yeah. And you know, it's so referring to like Hudson's statue, you know, it's so interesting. Basically, Carlyle is like, here's this one group of people who are in a way kings, who still have that role, that sort of magic sacred role of monarchical leadership. And what do? They make sausage and like they market like bad railway securities or whatever, right? And you know, of course, like the blockchain is our equivalent of the railroad, right? You know, and so you're basically like, you know, Hudson would be like Mark Zuckerberg or something. And so you basically, and he so accurately like sort of like combines his hope for this kind of leader because he sees that it's the only kind left with this kind of mocking pessimism. You know, it's like there's some quote from some guy the other year or whatever who was like, the best minds of my generation are selling ads, you know. And there's, you know, that's a very deep resonance for me. But yeah, I mean, he's a total shit poster. I mean, the occasional discourse is one long shit post, right?
But you see, as a the thing that's very interesting about Carlyle, I can't really think of anyone else who's like this, is that he's kind of writing non-fiction, right? And there's a little there's a little kind of bit of journalism in there as well. It's kind of I can't really think of many other people who did it, like maybe Peter Hitchens today or somebody like that.
Hunter S. Thompson, he immediately brings to mind Hunter S. Thompson.
But what I was going to say is that on top of the fact that he's writing this kind of non-fiction journalistic type thing. That he does have literary devices. So the occasional discourse has actually got something that we recognize today as like a almost like a postmodern frame.
Oh yeah. I mean,
device, you know.
Sartor Resartus is full of that as well, right? You know, and Sartor Resartus as well. I mean, you know, why am I blanking on this? Laurence Sterne isn't the first postmodern novelist, which he probably is. You know, Carlyle would certainly have a good claim for that for Sartor Resartus. And so, you know, not only is the occasional discourse this immense shitpost, but it's this like actually postmodern shitpost. I mean, you're absolutely right.
He's playing with
voice
in narratology. They call it the author, the implied author, the audience, the implied audience. And by the end of it, you're thinking like, who is he even writing this for? Like he's already
right. No, he's writing it for himself. He's like I mean, you know. He's writing it for himself. I mean, you know, and that's possibly a flaw, but he's also, I mean, I feel seen, I feel spoken to, I don't know. so yeah, this is, sorry, go on.
Why didn't I ask you my second question then, which is why should people read Carlyle today?
People should read Carlyle today because Carlyle resets the bar for them in many ways. And first of all, you have this incredible level of just sort of prophecy that you see in them, because Carlyle is one of the few people in the 19th century who really expects that the 20th century is going to be the complete and utter shit show that it turns out to be. And that, you know, for that alone, you know, you're basically, when you sort of go back to the earliest people who were right about anything, you will find that they have the sort of the freshest, most unique perspectives, because those perspectives are theirs alone. That's not sort of blended with a zeitgeist or something. They were, you know, the people who saw it. So they tend to be very kind of unique in their perspectives in that way. That's just one sort of good reason to read Carlyle.
I was just going to mention on the idea of Carlyle as a prophet. You know, they called him the sage of Chelsea. One of the things I was struck by, I think it's in the occasional discourses, it could be somewhere else, where he basically makes a prediction. He says, look, if you look at Haiti, in the next 150 years, it's going to be bloodshed. It's not going to get anywhere. And in 150 years from now, it'll be exactly the same as it is now. And it's kind of like, all right, okay, that's some pretty accurate prophecy.
That's some pretty accurate predictions. Now he makes wrong predictions on the same subject. He predicts that basically, you know, outside of a state of slavery, Africans in America won't thrive when they have to compete with Europeans, and that basically didn't come true. That was actually, you know, like I think most objective historians would have to agree that the period between slavery and civil rights is the most productive period in African American history, and that's certainly something to reckon with in both directions. But you know, the accuracy of, you know, a prediction, like, I mean, the set of people that would have agreed with him about, for example, Haiti not developing at the time would have been very, very small. And of course, now, you know, you sort of see the people who are the heirs of the people who believe that Haiti was a bright new future have sort of retconned all sorts of excuses for this, like, oh, they had massive foreign debt to France that they had to pay off, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, none of which is, you know, super convincing to me. But yeah, I mean, just the, like, you know, whenever you're sort of struck by those sort of kind of blades of truth that come out of nowhere, it's like a single malt whiskey. It's like, you know, this is coming from one person because no one else had that idea at this point. And so you're sort of experiencing the idea in this kind of pure, unsmooth, unblended form. And it's all wrong about things. It's like, but it's like, you know, I would say a comparison to that, which I recently read, which was fascinating, is, I guess you're not really a continentalist, and, you know, nor am I, but one has to make an exception for Ernst Jünger. And I was reading Jünger's Paris Diaries, which were published, you know, fairly recently in English, because I'm a Philistine and only speak English. And, you know, they're rather remarkable in many ways. Of course, one never knows how much a period diary has been retconned a little bit, but I would think that, you know, Jünger might be more likely to retcon the writing than the details. But in any case, Jünger has posted, the author of this incredible World War One military memoir, is posted to France as a kind of a cultural attaché to the German embassy, which is not at all a bad place if you have to be a German officer in World War II, although he almost gets nicked because a lot of his friends are involved in the July 20th thing, the bombing, you know, like the Tom Cruise Valkyrie people, right? And but one of the things that happens to Jünger while he's in Paris is he gets wind of the Holocaust. And so he starts to kind of look into it in the way that a person with good organizational connections in some institution looks into something like the Holocaust. And the and it's so interesting because his sort of discovery of that in this diary, which, you know, thereupon becomes a fairly dangerous diary. I mean, a lot of people had dangerous diaries back then. And he's basically sort of investigating and kind of theorizing on, in a literary sense, because, of course, he's a very literary person, kind of the sort of spiritual and cultural causes and nature of this. And he's doing so on his own accord. He's never even taken a Holocaust studies class. Like, he hasn't even had a year of Holocaust studies, right? You know, and so there's this kind of freshness to, but he sort of accurately glimpses the moral dimensions of it. Mm-hmm. And this is just like, you know, the freshness of it is unbelievable, because it's all him.
Yeah. One of the things I was going to say is that when I first read Carlyle, I felt like he was coming from such a radically different place from where we are, or from where what I was coming from, that you then start to question all of the bits of like common sense wisdom that you were taught as a kid, you know.
Sure.
In all sorts of ways. Like, I'll give you something very simple. The idea that you could have a wise leadership is so foreign to us.
We're so used it really to being, like, is. Cynical, it really is.
Right.
It is.
He starts talking about the captain of the ship and, you know, all of this sort of thing, it kind of hits you in a way that you've never even considered it before.
And you've never even considered. Yeah. No. Go, please.
Sorry. I realized that my school teachers had basically trained me to see Carlyle, or all of Carlyle's views, as being like somehow childish or somehow like unthinkable, you know,
or criminal, really.
Or criminal,
like,
yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And then you sort of get into psychologizing these kinds of criminal views, and then you basically are like, you know, you should sort of, there's a sort of, you know, inversion thing that I do to sort of deparochialize people in time, where I sort of ask you to notice that out of sort of all the smart people and all the intellectual cultures in history, yours is the only one that's had this particular perspective. So are you sort of confident enough to say that you're right when everyone else is wrong? Or moreover, basically, when you think about your sort of linguistic framing for this situation in which you're different from everyone else, you do it in a strange way, whereas you basically put everyone, you consider yourself as normal, and you put everyone else in a sort of exclusive category. So an example of an exclusive category like that would be the word Gentile, which means different things depending on whether you're in Israel or in Utah. It's means not having a certain belief. And so if you're not a Mormon, you know, you're in Utah, at least you're a Gentile. You could be a Jew, you could be a Buddhist, you could be a Catholic, whatever, you're a Gentile. And, you know, what this does is it basically creates this kind of false category of not us, whereas the real category is us. And so once you basically flip that around and say the real category is us, what we have is not the sort of the absence of this reactionary view. What we have is a modern revolutionary view. And so, you know, what you're basically saying is you're dividing everything into like revolutionary and non-revolutionary, which is a very parochial way to think. It's like if you're, you know, an Icelander, you're like everything is either Icelandic or non-Icelandic. Well, you know, the rest of the world is a lot bigger than Iceland, and the rest of history is a lot bigger than the 20th century. And so basically, you know, when you sort of look at the contest between how Carlyle and his contemporaries thought, and Carlyle was you know, thought much like more like a person from previous centuries than from his own time. But if you basically look at that contrast and you say, in this dispute, what should be, you know, the null hypothesis? Should the reactionary perspective that basically everyone held for most of the everyone all over the world for most of the last 10,000 years held be the null hypothesis, and the revolutionary hypothesis have to prove itself? Or should it be the other way around? Should the rest of history have to justify itself to us, or should we have to justify ourselves to the rest of history? And, you know, you'll notice that the question of should we justify ourselves to the rest of history requires, even to answer that question, you have to learn the standards of the rest of history, meaning basically history before the 19th century. And like that, even learning those standards and applying them in a way where they could even perform that exercise, I think is almost impossible for even people involved in like most historical programs in the university. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think if you asked the average like Oxbridge, you know, undergraduate or even grad student to say, how would a Victorian reactionary like Carlyle judged the 20th century, I think they would be horrified by that exercise. And also they would just get a lot of it wrong.
Yeah. I mean, I have had a go at trying to teach students. You know, I used to teach Paradise Lost and Faustus, but try to get them to see, like, one of the questions I was asked was like, has history gone more towards the side of Satan, or has it gone more towards the side of the angels?
If you have to ask. Yeah, sure. Right. Yeah.
So some modern readers might find Carlyle's style a bit heavy going at first. Do you have any tips on how to get into him?
I would say kind of, you know, let it wash over you to a certain extent. Two things. One, let it wash over you to a certain extent. Second, when he makes a reference to something you don't know about or don't understand, feel absolutely free to like pull up Wikipedia and like look at this. The one thing that I really am against doing is reading any kind of modern commentary on your old text before you read the old text. If you have a book with an introduction, do not start by reading the introduction. You can read it after you read the book, but like, don't read excerpts, don't read, you know, modern, anything that's sort of framing this in a modern way. It'll just ruin your palate. It's like, you know, taking a tablespoon of molasses before you like try the latest Bordeaux, you know? But you know, if you want to look up sort of facts, like, you know, you really can't read Carlyle's French Revolution without knowing the history of the French Revolution. I just don't think that is possible. And you'll be mighty confused. And so, you know, basically, if those, you know, if that story, if that sort of those historical, you know, textbook schoolboy facts aren't kind of stuck in your head already, you know, Wikipedia is going to be great for that and should enable you to chase most of those references. Like, I would say, rather than really puzzling over a work, it's better to kind of read it twice so that the sense of it kind of sinks in more. I think actually in some ways the best introduction to Carlyle, for the a really gentle introduction, which the Latter-day pamphlets, and to me the Latter-day pamphlets, if I were putting together an edition of that, I would include the Occasional Discourse and Shooting Niagara, and because I think they're basically bookends of the same kind of course of rhetoric in some ways. You know, of course the Occasional Discourse is one of the most dangerous things ever put on paper, but you know, like reading, just like let it, you know, treat it like you're reading like some like god awful postmodern, you know, thing from the 80s, like Foucault or whatever, like, you know, like a lot of these, you know, or Judith Butler. Like, now if you're reading Judith Butler, she's actually sort of filling her work with gobbledygook to try and confuse you. Carlyle isn't doing that. Carlyle actually can be parsed and means everything he's saying, and still sort of, you know, your like tactic that you learn in school or while reading all this god awful stuff of kind of, you know, skipping over it a little bit and you know, is likely to be useful. Like, you know, you know, don't feel like you have to learn a bunch of facts and there will be a quiz. Reading Carlyle should be a more kind of spiritual experience than that.
Yeah, I mean, when you said just let him wash over you, more than any other writer I can think of, he is like experiencing like an avalanche or something. Like it just keeps on coming, and you can kind of see him get, like, he works himself up, and once he gets going, it's like, God, we've been on the same rant for like five pages now, and he's still going.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You can see the Scottish preacher in him, you know, like some like mad covenanter, you know, like John Knox or whoever, getting up and ranting. And it was a great age for rants. I don't know. You know, as a ranter, I feel sad that I missed that period. But
what do you consider his essential works and why?
Well, certainly the Latter-day pamphlets. I would say, if you read the Latter-day pamphlets and then you go from that to the French Revolution, which is, you know, an absolutely stellar book, you know, that and, you know, my first two would definitely be Latter-day pamphlets and French Revolution. I think after that, the Past and Present and Sartor Resartus. I think both sort of give you more, sort of fill out the dimensions of Carlyle. Again, I generally, include Occasional Discourse and Shooting Niagara in the pamphlets. These are very dangerous works, folks, very dangerous. I Heroes and Hero Worship is fine. There's a lot of essays that are good. I want to mention you had this as one of your later questions. The essay on Dr. Francia is a particular favorite of mine. I don't know of much. I mean, I guess I have read Frederick the Great. It was actually in a volume that had been printed in England in the 1890s and then had a book plate from a German on it, but the pages had never been cut. And so I was reading this wonderful, wonderful volume.
I had an uncut Carlyle. There's a volume called it's called Miscellaneous Essays. I had to, you know, all the pages.
You folded the page and put it in. Yeah, any good bookmark can be used to slit those edges. Actually, you don't even need a letter opener. But it's kind of fun ripping the pages on this thing that no one has ever read. But yeah, I mean, you know, or that, or like, you know, the one on the Kings of Norway, you know, that's really kind of late Carlyle. You know, once you've read those four things that I mentioned, I would just start basically, you know, dipping around in the miscellaneous essays, of which he wrote, many. But those are my, and Heroes and Hero Worship, it's a fine book. It's not as good as past and present, I don't think. But how does that compare to your sort of order of attack?
I think it's kind of the same ones. The occasional discourse, like you keep on saying, is dangerous, but it's not really a defensive. Like, the reason it's so controversial is because he appears to defend slavery, but if you really, yeah, really understand what he's saying, he's defending this notion of social bonds, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
One of the thoughts I've had quite a bit over the past few years is that I think that lots of people, I'm not saying everybody, right? Probably not me or you. But a lot of people in their heart of hearts may be happier as like peasants or serfs chained to a particular place. And okay, this sounds absurd, but why do people have nostalgia for like
sure I mean,
or coal mining towns and things like this? I mean, it feels to me that people really harbor of something like that, you know, something like the peasant serf life.
Well, you know Goldsmith's Deserted Village, right? I mean, you know, I don't know if you read a piece I wrote recently on my blog. I got into Ruskin, of course, an acolyte, mm-hmm, of Carlyle. Most people consider Ruskin a lib. I wrote this, yeah. Paul Gottfried was like, do you want to write a piece for Chronicles about, we're doing a series on right-wing thinkers, can you do Carlyle? I'm like, man, I already did Carlyle. What about Ruskin? He's like, Ruskin is a liberal. I'm like, I will prove you wrong. I will write the essay-based Ruskin. And then he thought my essay was too meandering and Carlyle-y, so he let me publish on my own blog. But which is totally fine. I've better graphic design than him anyway. And why should I give my work to other people, really? But I have to feed the Substack machine. But like Ruskin sort of, I mean, Carlyle is sort of so amazing in this sense, because if you basically read, you know, the extended Latter-day pamphlets, including Occasional Discourse and Shooting Niagara, which is a very late work, you basically see the roots of both 20th century liberalism and 20th century fascism. Like, you have one branch that goes out sort of through Ruskin to the Fabians, and you have another that basically goes out through, you know, really looks a lot like, you know, the Fuhrer Prinzip or whatever. And both of these connections are true, and all it tells you is that Carlyle is the father of the whole 20th century, you know, and all of it, right? You know, and he even predicts how it would turn out. And so when you sort of look at the question of kind of what it means to be, like, of course, you know, Merry England was Merry England, even when it did not, serfdom died out in England relatively early, but you still had peasants, you still had people who, you know, lived in this harmonious, if certainly difficult, medieval way. And it's very easy to say, like, I mean, certainly people in the modern world, like the Amish, who've sort of adopted a quasi-medieval lifestyle, including a quasi-medieval attitude toward technology, have, mm-hmm, some of the highest sort of quality of life and life satisfaction scores that exist around, right? And so I feel like one of the things that we frequently do that sort of results in this, it's like our attitude toward, when we look at, say, I mean, slavery is a very general term, but when we look at various versions of kind of American agricultural slavery, what we're looking at is, we're basically looking at, you know, wow, this would suck, but we're looking at it from the perspective of ourselves. And from the perspective of ourselves, it would suck to be basically, especially Deep South, plantation slave in the 1850s, and it would also suck to be a sharecropper picking cotton in the 1870s, And the sort of the difference between us and someone who has to pick cotton all day, or even who can pick cotton all day, because I don't think either of us could even really do it. And sort of the question of like, what is their kind of legal status, or is it easier to be a slave in the 1850s or a sharecropper in the 1870s? I think most historians of the period will tell you that it was a damn sight harder to be a sharecropper in the 1870s. And both of these things involve picking cotton all day. And like, and so we can't really, like, one of the things that happens when you say, hey, maybe it's all right to be a peasant, is it's like, well, it really depends who you are. And today we have both nobles and peasants. I can walk around Palo Alto or whatever, and I can see the nobles who go to work at Google and the peasants who are cutting their grass in the morning, right? Mm-hmm. And like this, as Carlyle once said about slavery, you can abolish the name of slavery, but you sort of can't change the structure of these kinds of relationships. There's no equality between the Google guy and the guy who does his landscaping. And so when you have sort of political theories that tell the Google guy that he's really the same as these people, of course, he basically is going to think all day about what would happen if I was, you know, taken away from my AI and made to clip grass all day. And it's sort of like you're mixing up the question of what it is to be this kind of person with the sort of experience of life for those kinds of people. And so, yeah, like, you know, don't project when you project yourself, you know, back into the, 16th century, you have to realize that you are someone who is going to think a lot more like a 16th century noble than like a 16th century peasant. Go on.
I was going to say that I think a lot of the Zoomers today, though, certainly the ones in my audience and probably the ones who read you as well, can probably recognize, though, that they, you know, if they look at their parents or their grandparents, they had a stable, a stable environment. They knew where their home was. They could have worked in a factory or a coal mine, sure, or wherever else it was. And now they understand instinctively that they have been thrust into nomadism. You know, they have become like modern.
Use Carlyle's word.
You know, they've become
the distressed needlewoman.
Yeah.
Except that they're not even distressed needlewomen. They're like distressed nobles. Or at least your students are, because they're your students, right? The distressed needlewoman go all the way down the social class, and you know, the Midwest is full of, you know, distressed needlewomen. And it's really tragic, because the distressed needlewoman, like, they're people, they're human beings. They basically degrade as human beings when there's no needling to be done. Although Carlyle, of course, was like, are these even needlewomen at all? Right. But like, when you see that kind of, like, nomadism is made for the noble. It's made for the aristocrat. It's the way that you would expect aristocrats to want to live. These aristocrats are still in worlds where they don't have enough community. They don't have enough. They sort of feel this tremendously sort of atomized journey that they're supposed to go on, in which, you know, at best they have these kinds of, you know, they have networks from school or whatever and so on. But it's like, these are not inherently deep and binding connections. One thing that's very hard for this generation to understand, even when they understand that they're missing that sort of connection and community, they're understanding that the voluntary and ephemeral nature of the ties that they find in nomadism are, you know, the flip side of their, you know, their sort of desire for those very lightweight relationships is more than anything what is collectively making it hard to develop those ties. And the strongest communal ties really always are the completely involuntary and contingent ones, your family, your town, your whatever. And these are people who live really in a world of chosen ties. And not only are these chosen ties, you know, of course, we live in an easy divorce world, you know, a world where even sort of marriage is rare and, you know, people have girlfriends even into their 30s and 40s. And so you have this world of very light relationships and very light and voluntary relationships. And people are like, sort of, I want heavier and deeper relationships. And it's very hard for them to see that the sort of the involuntary character of that comes along with them. Does that make sense?
I remember one of the hardest things for me to admit on my own kind of intellectual journey is that I grew up in this little town in Wales, I couldn't wait to leave. I was listening to the Smiths and David Bowie, and I thought I have to get away from here, you know. I could still go back now and probably some of the same people who were driving around doing the same stuff, you know, 18, 20 years ago are still doing the same things now, right? And I, as a teenager, you know, especially growing up under Tony Blair, who encouraged you to, I guess, look down on traditional blue-collar jobs. And
yes, everybody in favor of Britannia. You're from Cool, you know, I'm speaking right here. Speaking to Cool Britannia. I got Cool Britannia on the line. Yeah.
Everybody had to be like kind of upwardsly aspirational, is very kind of, in fact, very managerial.
Again, everyone, this trope of like everyone needs to be a noble is like so destructive.
But it took me quite a while to come to terms with the fact that the things I wanted myself are probably not reflective of most people. When I say most people, like 90% plus, and if the you know, pandemic has taught us anything, is that most people are like the, you know, when the elite theorists talk about the mass, they really do exist. And they act like masses all the time.
They act like masses. They're not nobles. And treating them like nobles is harmful and dangerous and bad. And they should be treated, you know, with great respect as the human beings who they actually are. And like, actually, there's a sort of, you know, you can almost get into a sort of identity cultural appropriation thing. I don't know, where you're basically not, it's not cultural appropriation, it's cultural hegemony. And, you know, when the upper classes are telling everyone in Portland or Dwarfy or wherever you're from, that they apologize for my caricature of the Welsh there. When the powers that be are telling everyone in a small town in Wales or a small town in Ohio, where my late wife is from, you know, that they have to live like the people in Greenwich Village or Palo Alto or London or wherever it is. They're basically, it's like you invaded, it's different from like invading some country and like converting their people to Christianity. It's a fully hegemonic act. And, you know, and realizing that it's both okay to be different, even from the people that you came from, because, you know, being promoted into nobility has always been a thing. And, you know, but that doesn't mean those people need to be like you, live like you, be forced to live like you, want to live like you. Like, that's just hegemony. And that's like,
The one other thing I just wanted to touch on while we're on this question of the involuntary relationships and the social bonds.
Sure.
There was a passage in Mosca that really jumped out of me when I was looking over the ruling class. There's this one moment where he's talking about the difference between feudal societies and bureaucratic societies. And he says, I mean, I'll just paraphrase him. I can't remember the exact phrase, but he basically says that this idea that there's been this massive gap between the rulers and the ruled, that's almost unbridgeable, is actually quite a recent thing. That if you like, the old baronial feudal lord was actually a man that the average peasant could understand and sit down and have a drink with, and you know, he was kind of coarse in the same way. Think of, I don't know, I mean, I call it
Carlyle celebrates this connection too. It's like you basically, you've gone from a, you know, just because the lord of the master is not the same as his peasant, they do exist in the same world. They will say hi if they, you know, cross each other in the street. You know, there's no generally sense of this being like this domineering and hostile relationship. It's an almost an extended, unless it's something really depraved and dysfunctional is going on, it's almost an extended family. And you get this replaced by this like world of like Morlocks and Eloy, right? And that changes me going on for quite a while.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say it, but I mean, it's like the middle class have not been bred to rule in the correct way. Like they don't, all of these horrible kind of class antagonisms seem to come from middle class notions of superiority that don't really seem to get that. I mean, I suppose that's why the high and the, you know, the juvenilia and high and the low versus the middle can be a thing, right? Because it's often the case that the tastes or the kind of moral sentiments of the high and the low are closer than they are to that middle kind of bourgeois.
Well, the way I usually define the three kind of basic classes is in terms of sort of life purpose, where I'm like, to be a noble is essentially to be at the top of the pyramid of needs and to have self-actualization as your life goal. Basically, it's, you know, if you're a noble, you know, your life purpose should be to make yourself amazing, however your society defines that. If you're a commoner, your life purpose is basically comfort and security. And if you're part of the underclass, your life purpose is immediate pleasure. And so, you know, you'll notice that basically sort of making yourself amazing in the lives of any particularly louche aristocracy is going to bleed over fairly rapidly into something that looks quite a bit like the pursuit of immediate pleasure. And so, I mean, there's sort of all sorts of resonances between that natural alliance. The rich are naturally patrons, the poor are naturally clients. What gets lost, of course, if sort of all the rich are patrons in general of all the poor, is the sense of reciprocal obligation, the sense of, like, you know, all this connective tissue sort of just gets kind of chopped into this abstraction. And still, basically, you know, the traditional alliance was this kind of interlocking sandwich of, you know, you have the aristocrats and the underclass against the commoners, but you also have the commoners and the king against the aristocrats. And most people familiar with the struggle would basically look at it and say, without a king, the commoners don't have a chance.
Yeah.
Because they simply can't, without a king, the commoners are like, the radiation of their energy is completely unfocused. They're like a flashlight as opposed to a laser. And, you know, that basically, that sort of willingness and ability to basically follow and serve is the thing that separates powerful commoners from powerless commoners. And yet this is counter to everyone's political instincts.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking a little bit about this before we came on air, but I mean, to use Carlyle's language, you know, ideally this king will be a great man, right? But we also have to be aware of the sham captain, the sham king.
Yes.
And I've been thinking a lot about this recently, where the right is always, there's something of this Carlylean great man built into the psychology of the right, I think.
Right. But they're always falling for shams.
Yeah. How do we stop it even happened to a certain extent with Rittenhouse in the past few weeks. And I said, like, as soon as the trial was over and I saw the kind of direction I saw, like what Rittenhouse, you know, he basically came out immediately and said, like, I support BLM and so on.
Right.
And I said, well, you know, this kid is not going to be, it's not going to be a hero. And I mean, I don't know if you've seen the picture, but he's already out there posing with Charlie Kirk, and you know, it's going to be like the scene.
Yeah,
the scene.
Yeah, of course, of course, of course. I mean, it's easy to forget that, you know, basically the like, this is conservatism for all these people. No, right? It has this institution, it has this structure. Like, they sort of don't, I mean, this is shifting a little bit, like, definitely. You know, I went to Yoram Hazzoni's National Conservative Conference down in Florida, where you know, I met a lot of cool people, but there were also I met, like, your own island's Mary Harrington, who had flown quite a distance to be there. A good writer. But, you know, it was an interesting mix of sort of, they had a certain number of, like, high profile establishcons. And then, you know, the floor is full of these, like, you know, 20 year old Zoomers, you know, and college students and the like. And the Zoomers are very lit and very based and very with it. But, like, these are very plugged in Zoomers. And the thing is, if you're just looking for, like, what's the opposite of liberalism, it's very easy to find Charlie Kirk. Charlie Kirk will, you know, unless you're, you can either find Charlie Kirk or, like, some strain of online Hitler, right? And, like, you know, neither of those things are sort of good or adequate or proper or, like, useful. They're actually useful pretty much to the powers that be, because one of them is a sham and the other one is kind of a straw man. And, you know, if you inhabit either, you're basically, you're going to zero. I think that basically sort of the actual dissident movement, if I could even call it that, I wouldn't even call it that, has to sort of be conscious of how sort of small it is in size relative to what it could be and what these things with kind of quasi mainstream distribution like the Charlie Kirks of the world can do. And yeah, I wouldn't, you know, like Kyle Rittenhouse is not an intellectual, right? I mean, you know, right. And so you're basically like, and I think also sort of hopes of broader impact are almost kind of inappropriate. And it's like, you know, do you even really want that? You know, once you basically are like, okay, I can, you know, I have a reasonably sized non-mainstream audience, you know, that can actually sort of earn me a living outside these institutions, I'm like, sure, who would not like a bigger living? Great, whatever. But, like, the thing is fine actually as the size it is, because what matters now is sort of the actual work that is created and not what you get people to do. You can't get anyone to do anything. You shouldn't be trying to get anyone to do anything. We're like, it's way too early for that, basically. And so that, you know, that, well, way too early. It's too early. It used to be way too early. Now it's just too early. But yeah, you know, sort of that level of just, like, sort of being patient with one of the things that, like, just in terms of being, like, a social network, which, you know, any group of people who think in similar ways is, it's much more important to have sort of high quality than high volume, because, yeah. I mean, for just a zillion reasons.
You're probably not aware of this, but I've talked about building a network of tens. Because that's what we need. It is essentially a kind of a vanguard who are able
A vanguard. And it's like, you'll go and, you know, you hear a lot of talk about, like, this University of Austin thing that some people are trying to create. And, you know, like, I know people who know people who are involved in that. And I look at it and I'm just like, there's two things wrong with it. One is that in a way it's not ambitious enough. It's not crazy enough. And it's like trying to become part of a system which it can never really become part of. I mean, if you basically say, I'm the University of X, it's like, okay, what is your U.S. News and World Report rank? Well, you know, if you don't care about your U.S. News and World Report rank, why are you even calling it that? And if you do care, you're going to find that you have to do the same things as everyone else. And, like, just don't, you know...
Yeah, you'll become, I mean, this is one of the great lessons of Robert McKells, who I've just been writing, writing the lecture on. He basically says that as soon as you're up and running and established, the institute, the thing that you build, the party, the organization will become conservative. Now, he doesn't mean that as in like...
Yeah, you know, I know what he means.
It will support the status quo. It will just become part of the establishment.
It will become part of the establishment unless it's actually involved in creating a new status quo. And so, you know, the basically the model, you know, your network of tens seems much more proper to me, because it's like, I'm like, if you're trying to build new institutions, like, don't start with the students. Starting with the students is just LARPing. It's cargo culting. Start with the masters. And, you know, your job is really to define, you know, if you create something where you have a collection of intellectuals, which is so stellar that people want to come there and pay money to learn from them, that's great. But if you basically start with the business of coming there and learning, then you know, that's a totally different thing. You're starting with this, like, you're starting too low. It's like you really have to start with just like, okay, let's recognize what's being done here, which is exemplary at the top, and then see how we can expand that and institutionalize it and structure it without losing its excellence. Does that make sense? Does that roughly the same idea? Are you still there?
Yeah. So, I mean, just to come back to Carlisle, I don't know how much longer you have here, Kirsten.
Sure. I do have to go in a few minutes. So
let's bang through these quick hits, okay? Do you have a favorite work of Carlisle's and why?
I would say it is definitely specifically really the first essay, The Present Time, in the Latter-day Pamphlets. Really, anyone who reads that and is not in some way inspired is like, they're just not on the same wavelength as me, I guess, man. I don't know. Do you have an equivalent? Do you have the,
I got to think about that. One of the things we haven't
talked Chartism about. Chartism is a great introduction to, but sorry.
Yeah, I was going to mention Chartism. One of the things we haven't talked about is absolute hatred for democracy, which is something else that I think that is at the root of a lot of issues as well. But Carlisle will kind of explain. Carlisle gives you a rationale.
In some ways it's funny to regard that from the present, because we have this abstract absolute love for democracy, and then we have, I mean, at least among intellectuals, this very concrete hate for populism, which is exactly the same thing. And you know, the contempt for populism that you see generally uttered is actually not only very similar to Carlisle's contempt, but if you look at sort of the roots of disdain for like politics and politicians historically, you'll see it running through sort of the progressives and the Fabians really to Carlisle. And so these ideas, right, you know, these anti-democratic ideas, which seem like these incredible dinosaurs, are actually flying around us like birds today. We just don't recognize, that these are anti-democratic ideas, right? Whenever people are like, trust science, not politicians, what do you think they're saying?
Well, one of the things I hadn't realized until I got deep into the secondary literature on elite theory is the extent to which those guys have actually been internalized by Harvard and Yale types. They did this move, right? They did it. So obviously you couldn't be anti-democratic after 1945, right?
Right.
So one of the things that the political scientists, you know, the Harvard and the Yale types did is they made this, they wrote all these essays saying, actually, if you really understand Pareto and Mosca and McKells, they were actually pro-democracy after all.
really? So I had no idea.
They came up with this idea called elitist democracy. Which has kind of been like There are whole papers written on elitist democracy where they they essentially say, yes, the elitists were right, but we can use democracy as our vehicle as elites, essentially.
Yeah, well, that is basically how, you know, it's a kind of managed democracy. I mean, whose phrase is that? Is it Putin's? Is it, you know, basically what Walter Lippmann, you know, discovers is actually democracy. You know, if you still basically believe in your praxis is that of elite theory, which certainly includes, you know, science must be in charge, and you want to basically preserve the image of, you know, the people as sham king. And how do you prop up the people as sham king? Well, if you basically by far the best way is to actually control their beliefs through psychological warfare so that they're always voting for the elite and following the elite. And then you have a system that is both democratic and aristocratic. And that's exactly what we were just talking about, right? And it just falls down when this control starts to break. It's
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of the things I have to laugh about reading Lippmann and Bernays is the way that they just, without batting an eyelid, they say, it's not that the public don't want this, they just haven't been educated.
Yeah. Oh, that's yeah. 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 They take it completely normally. They don't. There's no tiptoeing around at all. They're just like, yeah, the mind of the public needs to be controlled, or they'll do all sorts of wacky shit and elect crazy people. We've seen it. You've seen it. You're going to see it, right? You know. And they're not entirely wrong. And so basically, you know, when they look at the people and say the people cannot govern, and the people are sort of getting worse and worse at governing, or, you know, less and less virtuous every year, it seems like these elite theorists have, you know, elitist, you know, this, these theorists of elitist democracy have a case. Unfortunately, the elite itself is also getting worse and worse every year, you know, which is a real dilemma, because as Aristotle teaches us, there's only two kinds of a political system, you know, aristocracy and democracy, and they both seem to suck. So it's unfortunate that there's no alternative, but unless I'm missing something. But
shall I just ask these final couple of questions?
Please.
So I think you've already answered this one. Any hidden gems off the beaten path, Carlyle?
Yeah, again, Dr. Francia, you know, which is this wonderful essay on basically to go over. You've read Dr. Francia, right?
Yeah, and I think my buddy Charlemagne, who's done a lot of stuff like popularizing your mm-hmm. not that you need popularizing, but, you know, if you tap in your name to YouTube, he'll probably his guides will be the first one. But he is contributing to Carlyle Day, and I think he's going to do his video on that essay.
It's a lovely essay, because basically the way, you know, Dr. Francia is the dictator of Paraguay and the longtime dictator of Paraguay, and Carlyle starts off his essay and where he's like, I'm gonna write about Dr. Francia, even though I don't know anything about Dr. Francia. I have these reports from the country, from like outraged British travelers that are just obviously worthless and completely biased and garbage. So we're just going to take these as garbage. And then we're going to like talk about not who Dr. Francia is, but who he should be. and so he sort of, you know, creates this picture that has something, I believe, to do with reality of like this amazing country, which is like the Prussia of South America, right? The now long since vanished Prussia of South America. And it's this beautiful, whimsical, Carlylean, you know, piece that's just, you know, kind of joyous, I guess. And I recommend it to everyone.
So obviously you're known across the internet and now across Fox News, apparently, for popularizing the NRX.
I never use those initials, actually, but that's fine.
I mean, that's what it's kind of known as.
Yeah, sure.
How important would you say Carlyle in general is to neo-reaction?
Well, you know, I've been inspired by Carlyle. Others have been inspired by Carlyle. There's so many other great Victorians and pre-Victorians even that you can read. Carlyle is just like, you know, he's an inspiration because he shows that basically this perspective achieved kind of a level of excellence that is just far above the like literary capacity of anyone in the New Yorker today. You know, there's just like, if you try to write like Carlyle, you might end up writing like Hunter S. Thompson. That's fine. You just find that you won't be able to do it. And that's because Carlyle is so amazing. So like, just as like, you know, if you're going to put someone on a pedestal, you know, his greatness has to be palpable. And I think that anyone just reading a page of Carlyle can see like no one ever wrote like this person before or since.
So my last question is that Carlyle seems to put a lot of emphasis in his works on the importance of God or transcendence or the absolute. When I read you, you have more of a feel of a kind of cool amoralist, almost like a Gen X James Burnham. Did you take any aspect, any of that aspect of Carlyle on board, the need for God?
Carlyle's, and you know, if you stoop to read my poetry, you'll find a lot of religious, spiritual, and Christian references in it. Carlyle had an interesting religious history where, of course, he was brought up as a strict Presbyterian, lost his faith in a very Enlightenment kind of way, and then experienced a spiritual awakening. And you know, the result of his spiritual awakening was not really anything like traditional Christianity in some ways. It did not really sort of fit in with the dogma of his day. That's what made him a neo-reactionary in some ways rather than a reactionary. You could say the same of Joseph de Maistre, you know, who was this Catholic arch-reactionary, but wrote and thought in the style of Voltaire. And the real reactionaries of his time were very confused about what to do with these people, because they didn't really have the right ant smell. They were kind of actually libs, but like libs who agreed with them in this strange way. And I think that also applies to Carlyle's religion, which was very, you might almost call it sort of more New Age in some ways. It basically was sort of a kind of personal, transcendent, and aesthetic experience for him. And in terms of the kind of aesthetic that defined, where, you know, for example, in Model Prisons, which is one of the Latter-day pamphlets, he's basically talking about, you know, God and the death penalty. And he basically manages to imbue this thing that most people today think of kind of, you know, as satanic and evil with a kind of divine energy. And you definitely do not have to be a sort of being, you know, believer in mysterious supernatural forces, and I'm not sure Carlyle himself was, to basically, you know, understand the spiritual aesthetic. And in fact, you know, one of the most powerful things in Carlyle that I keep coming back to is his epigraph for the Latter-day pamphlets, which is basically this, you know, transliteration from an old Scottish novel of the principle that God helps those who help themselves. And it's sort of directed in the direction of people, what Strauss would call historicists, people who believe in Whig history, or people who believe in, you know, sort of historical determinism. And he's like, no, the future here is not fixed. Like, you have to actually go, God, and have to actually change it. God is not going to do this for you. God is not going to, you know, the purpose of action in the world is to create a world that is more in tune with the will of God. God won't do this for you. You know, therefore, you know, an atheist and a Carlylean agree that on an aesthetic of what it means to do God's will, and we agree that God is not going to do it for you. So the question of whether God in any sense exists becomes, I would say, somewhat moot out of that. And I think that's, you know, that's probably something Carlyle and I could agree to disagree on. I'd love to meet him, but you know how it is.
Yeah, I should mention you mentioned de Maistre there. Imperium Press sent me my copy of the major works of de Maistre that's just had a
major, they just released that. I've got to order that. There's this wonderful crop of kind of new based imprints springing up that's really you know, very, very encouraging to me. I think these people are making decent cash, and they're doing great work. I just did a seminar again, down at Zephyr near Stanford on the ancient city, which was super great. You know, Fustal de Collange, that's, you should absolutely read that. That's sort of like
that arrived today as well. The ancient city.
Excellent. Yeah. You'll just get lost in that book. It's amazing. It's worth reading twice over. It really, you know, sort of puts the whole classical world into perspective in so many ways. It was like, I recommended it to this Silicon Valley VC and it became like one of the three books that he recommends to everyone. You know, it's like, you know, it's a great work. So, yeah. I think I should probably wrap up here. Any final questions or comments?
No. I was just going to, I mean, on, there could probably be a whole stream on like Carlyle and religion. He's always described as like a Calvinist without the theology, or an atheist despite himself, and all these kind of strange, like he's kind of very confusing when it comes to that issue. So but it's definitely a part of his thinking that's he sees it everywhere. I mean, especially in like Heroes and Hero Worship, it's
The heroes, and it has to be act as an extension of God in this world. Like that's what makes him a hero.
Anyway, Curtis, thank you so much for coming on. We should keep in touch.
All right. Yes, absolutely. And certainly, if you're ever on the West Coast, let me know, and I'll do the same if I'm ever in the UK, and maybe we could meet up in masks or something like that. All right. Take care. And cheers. Have a great one.
Thank you very much, everyone.